This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm, and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be happy, whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, or meeting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be happy. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child. So with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, free from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness. One should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world.
Okay,
no worries, Chris. Just let, yes, as Wazzy mentioned, that just let me know if anything goes wrong with the audio, and I've just got to unplug, maybe replug, and see how things go.
Certainly, thank you.
Okay, so with meditation practice, so something I've been doing a lot of lately, and this, it gives you a much more, let's say, like a clearer perspective of your life, greater, say, your emotional balance, stability, a greater degree of, say, like inner joy, you know, lightheartedness, you know, sort of more sort of ease, emotional ease in the mind is the, is this contemplation of say, changeability and Nietzsche, you know, that you see in the Buddhist teaching. Many of you are well aware of it, and but I've really started to work this one over the last, say probably about 18 months, and it's just working very, very well. There's, I mean, you know, it's similar, it's like the Brahma Viharas, you know, you see a lot of good qualities come out of Brahma Viharas, but this Nietzsche principle, which I'll put emphasis on, is it's really worth paying attention to and actually, you know, kick-starting and getting it rolling, because as all of you know, that the Anicca Dukkha Anatta is at the core. It's the core trunk of the, yeah, the ultimate reality of the universe. So everything inside this mind and body, everything that you see throughout the cosmos, is essentially permeated with changeability, with say, like, unsatisfactoriness to a degree, and the emptiness principle, and that developing that perception of changeability, as simplistic as it is, when you do these mantras, when you're walking and sitting, you're on retreat, or you're moving around the house, and you could be washing dishes, and doing bits and pieces, even, looking after the kids out in the back garden. That, if you have time, where you're not, you're not working, you don't have any major responsibilities, that it's well worth developing even that one mantra per minute. Like a changeability mantra, say, like consciousness is changeable, or could be perception, feeling, thoughts, thinking, memories. You can think of 1,001 principles you could consider. And for myself, I tend to do it for at minimum, say, 1 to 2 hours at a stretch. But, this particular, as simple as it is, it's one of the best practices I've ever seen. And the thing is, to give you an idea, the kind of emphasis the Buddha put on it, that he said with the monastics, and especially when that's actually fortified and reinforced by, say, deep samadhi, he said the contemplation of the three characteristics is your work. It's like your duty. The words where he said your work and duty, because there's no, there are different avenues when it comes to realization of the Buddha's teaching, the realization of the ultimate nature of the universe. But the Anicca Dukkha Anatta is especially emptiness, changeability is more user friendly. Some other ways, approaches to, say, realization of ultimate truth may be a little bit too heavy, too challenging. So, but the changeability of, it's got a very good energy to it. And even though I don't do metta or Brahma Viharas at all, I've probably got the best mind state I've seen, in a long time. So, once you start to get that rolling, the perception of changeability, and you make it quite firm inside your mind, and then you start to see what it can do. And I can with reflection, I can see that I'm getting more joy and more happiness, more lightheartedness, and more awareness with this this style of practice, this way of practice, than many, many other things I've done. And I've done dozens and dozens of different types of meditation practice, but this one is, as the Buddha reinforced, this is something that is well worth paying attention to. And especially with the lay fraternity, because you guys are so busy and you've got a lot on your plate, that even just, but many of you are, you're solid practitioners. You've been going 10, 20, 30 years plus. Even that one mantra per minute, you can be a CEO, you can be a policeman, social worker, you can be working in the hospital system, a doctor, registered nurse, whatever. But, even that one mantra per minute, just one, you choose the mantra which resonates with you, you do it once, every 60 seconds. And, you'll see that's, easily. I see it within 30 minutes. But you will easily see with that. The regular practitioners will easily see it within hours. The very casual practitioners maybe could easily be 2 or 3 days. You see that under that background samadhi, the firmness, that increased awareness, the sharpness of the mind, because you've got that very light samadhi rolling, which is with you all day and night. Outside your sleeping hours, but even that samadhi can go into one's dream world where you get like how can I explain it? You can get these quite amazing dream states, very true to life, and the colors are very vibrant, and you can actually feel yourself within the dream. You're walking and talking within the dream state, and the incredible spaciousness. You're in mansions and small, I wouldn't say small palaces so much, but huge mansions with massive rooms and high ceilings. And you go into a room and you've got like a crystal roof section with the like St. Peter's Cathedral. That open circle to the universe, gazing out in the universe. So you can go into these dream states with this kind of samadhi, and you actually feel that you're there. You can you're talking with other people. It's almost like in the dream state it feels real, but naturally you understand when you wake, it's a dream. But it's very, very tangible and very The sensory experience is quite strong. But so, you know, you see different things can happen with that Nietzsche principle. And it's like the internet in a sense where, you know, the internet is connected in many, many ways with many, many threads. And that Nietzsche sanya, because it permeates everything, that it starts to give you a feel for other things. You know, you think to yourself, how can you possibly, you know, come to an understanding or relate to deeper things just by doing this very simplistic practice? But it's not to be underestimated, because everything, you know, throughout the universe is permeated with changeability. So it's like that, I think that Zen principle, when you understand one, you understand the all. So when you understand a Nietzsche, when you make that, especially with the regular practitioners, you make that view, that perception, that way of looking really, really firm in one's mind on a daily basis, that when you come time to leave this earth, you know, you don't lose that at all. You take that underlying firmness, you take the samadhi, you take the contemplation, you take it with you into that next birth. And because it's a firm, tangible principle that the Buddha emphasized, you know, 100 times over, you know, in the sutras, that as soon as you arise in the next rebirth, you've already got that, you know, at least to the surface, to the intermediate level in the mind, and it will keep you on the path. It won't allow you, when the Nietzsche sanya is strong, it won't allow you to basically lose the path. And people come as incredibly complicated, and you know, unless you've got incredible psychic power, you can't always know exactly where and when people will arise, for how long, under what circumstances. But when you've got a Nietzsche sanya really firm inside the mind on a daily basis, with that meditation and with your reflection on life, it's firmly embedded in the mind, and it keeps you close to the path, keeps the path firm, and it's very 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 difficult for you to lose. Say like time between lifetimes, when the Buddha's teaching, what the Buddha emphasizes firm in the mind, is very very difficult to lose the path and lose one or two lifetimes with, you know, in lower worlds, for, you know, could be significant durations of time. So when you have that principle firm, that perception of impermanence, that as the samadhi develops, you've already got that sense of the grounding is there. So, you know, sometimes the contemplation is actually easier for many of the practitioners than samadhi. Samadhi, I mean, really good samadhi can take a long time. It could easily, even for the forest monks, easily 10 to 20 years, sometimes even longer, 30 years. I mean, living alone out in the forest, even after 20, 30 years, they still haven't got the samadhi together when it comes to the jhanas. But you know, this is not an easy thing to do. You know, even in the old days, they really had to put a lot of effort. They had to put their lives on the line. They're living alone in the forest with all the difficulties and the illness and the bugs and everything you can possibly think of. In a very simple, I wouldn't say deprived, but you know, very very basic forest existence, where you have to look after oneself, you know. So you know, that particular principle, you know, it branches out, you know, it's like the tree, the core of the trunk, and everything else like branches off from that. And you know, you may see and know things that other people just don't notice. Every you know, all the practitioners have a degree of background samadhi where it makes you sensitive, aware, gives you a degree of sharpness where you can contemplate, you can know and see things. But that, you know, that's where that Nietzsche sanya, emptiness can get you a little bit too detached. You know, you've got to be a bit careful with it, you know, especially when you're things like crossing a road in front of traffic and what, you know, you've got to be very careful with that one. Can really space people out. If it's something you have to sense. Some people are okay with it, but you know, maybe some people aren't. Because you have, especially when you're working for a living, you've got responsibilities. You know, you've got to be, You know, you need to be sharpened on the ball. You can't make too many mistakes when you're running around in general society, or you're using power tools and all this kind of stuff. You need to be careful. So I'd like to do that that Anicca principle again. So what we'll do it right through for the 30 minute session. I want you to choose a topic which really is quite important to you. It resonates with you. It can be absolutely anything within the mind experience, anything inside the world. It can be flowers, it could be trees, it could be anything within biology, chemistry, quantum physics, different elements you can consider. So you choose the topic. And keep right away from the body. Don't do any of the body practices, even earth, wind, water, things like earth. You've got to be careful. Things like wind, air, and water are reasonably safe, but you're better off going for natural things that you see in the forest, you see in the garden. It could even be little bugs, ants, insects. Something which was really quite important to you. Memories, feelings, it's all tangible, tangible stuff. So you choose that topic, and what we'll do is we'll say that the meditation is reasonably firm, focused, and it's not too broad, because then it's much more difficult to get peaceful. We'll focus on the feelings around the mouth. So we'll be doing the mantra with the breathing meditation, and we'll be focusing right around the feelings around the mouth. It's very clear, very distinct. Nerving endings are quite strong. You can follow that without great difficulty. That feeling sense is always there. And what we'll do things like, we'll keep it nice and simple. We'll do things like, say breathing out, say like flowers. Breathing in, breathing out are changeable. Breathing in, breathing out, flowers. Breathing in, breathing out are changeable. So you can choose absolutely anything in nature, anything within the mind experience. And very, very short, two-syllable mantra. As on the out-breath, breathing out, you do your little mantra. So we'll do that for the next 30 minutes, and I'll talk you guys through it. So if there's any beginners, if you can get yourself in a comfortable position, you can sit in a chair, or even lay on the floor, or actually on your side. If anyone has any pain or any kind of physical injury, they can lay on their side, even on the carpet with a comfortable pillow. If you lay on your back, people tend to drift off. They can fall asleep very, very easily. But as the Buddha, went to Parinibbana, his consciousness became to cessation, extinct. The consciousness ceased completely as he went into Parinibbana. The Buddha was in the lion's posture on his side, supporting his head with his hand, with one foot upon the other, the body, straight, like you have a rod down your back, through your legs, down through your feet. So the body, the body's very, very straight but comfortable. As for people who have any, any sickness or need to lie down, so you can just sit in your most comfortable chair on your cushion. And it's good to cross the legs if you can, and put the hands together, because it draws energy inwards. It's anyone who does Qigong, Tai Chi will tell you, as soon as you cross the limbs, then the samadhi circuit is drawn inwards, it's something you can actually feel as a meditator. So just get yourself, just make sure your back is nice and straight. If you're sitting up, you can breathe fully into the chest, nothing tight around the waist, wrists, or the throat. And just breathe slowly, fully into the chest. And make a start with your little mantra. So we'll only do one mantra. And so make it a nice one. you like, and focusing on the feelings with the breath meditation around the mouth together with your mantra of choice. So as the meditation progresses, just try to relax all the feelings in the face, around the eyes. Relax the chest and the arms and legs together. As you breathe in and out of the body, try to relax the experience of breathing. So as we relax the physical body, try to relax the breath, the process of breathing as much as possible. Breathing down deeply into the base of the abdomen. So as the meditation continues on, if you still find that you're thinking excessively, what you can do to help calm the mind a lot faster is to understand, you know, the thoughts, the feelings which are coming up. So just look, in a simple way, just look into these things and understand where they come from, who they're connected with, the emotions. You know, no matter how trivial it is, you know, no matter if you've been through it 101 times, you know, when you contemplate like this, it increases energy. I mean, you know, it's the kind of energy which can almost stop you sleeping at night once you do this. So because the excessive thinking, strong feelings, there's something there which is not understood, and then when you contemplate, investigate, understand, then the mind, you know, lets go. You have to teach one's mind. You know, the mind doesn't automatically understand. You have to teach yourself as the months and years go by, and then the mind, you can see it. It starts to calm, starts to settle, and it becomes more peaceful as it lets go, it understands and lets go. Okay, we're coming towards the end of the session. So as you look at the meditation process and see what actually works for you to get the mind fairly, you know, reasonably calm and peaceful, because different techniques work better for certain people. I ring the bell 3 times. You can open your eyes when you're ready.
Well, certainly, John, as clear as a bell. That was wonderful. Thank you.
That's good to hear, Chris.
What would you like to do? Would you like to continue with your talk or have some questions?
Yeah, you choose the topic, Chris, and we'll see what we can do.
Well, Alyssa is left us with the topic. Unfortunately, she couldn't stay for the full session. She would like you to talk about spiritual joy.
Spiritual joy.
Both within meditation and outside of meditation versus the joy that we understand in Western culture.
Okay, as many of you guys know the teaching where the Buddha talked about, that pure form of joy, which is more like intuitive, intrinsic, internally based. You know, so you got the joy which is based on, say, like living in the world. You know, and we know all the interesting, exciting things that we can do. You know, the many amazing, fascinating things that we can do on the level of the world, and people can do a lot of good things as well. So, in essence, that in meditation you have got a stronger emphasis on developing, wholesome states. You know, when you go internally into the meditation, that will have a very, very firm effect, directly on your mind, to your physical body, to a lesser degree with qi and health. But that process of meditation will smooth and refine and take the rough edges of a person, and it will allow the deeper, more meaningful qualities to come up to the surface, and one of them is, you know, is that sense of the inner joy, the spiritual joy that we, and happiness that we get from the meditation process. And also there's that other parameter where we develop a sense of joy and happiness in the world, which is not just based on, regular, I wouldn't say mundane, but like the regular things, you know, the everyday things that people can do. You know, we'd say traveling and it could be anything. It could be sports. It could be gaming. You know, lots of fascinating things that people do in the world. But for people who want to develop a sense of happiness in the world, as many of you know, that, you know, when you you conduct or you express that wholesome, like a wholesome mentality out within the sphere of the world, that you have a sense of, you know, your sense of friendliness, you help and support others, you know, you don't harm yourself or other beings, and you know, you treat other people like your friends, you're like your spiritual friends, even it could be even complete strangers. So you know, if you see opportunities to help others, you know, you'll do so within the limits of your ability. So it's a matter of being a good quality person within the sphere of the world. And, you know, so when one is a good person doing good things in general society, you get that inner joy, you know, the happiness, it's the sense of the goodness, you know, you're feeling good about, you know, the positive things, positive qualities you're developing, radiating towards other people, you know, being of service, helping and supporting other people in could be very, very small ways, and even things like, you know, feeding, you know, things like could be crumbs from one's kitchen top for, you know, like small birds in the garden, or could be, you know, could be anything, you know, very, very little things, but it still cuts the ice in the sense that when you do good things, I mean, for anyone, you know, it could be for animals, even for little ants and for insects in the garden, there's going to be a positive effect from that. And so some people think, oh, you know, who wants to be a goody-goody, and, you know, why can't I just look after number one? And you know, one can have this very, you know, if people are very, the unhappiness or the most unhappy people I see, both in community and in general society, tend to be people who think of themselves too much. They've got this kind of could be anything. Could be selfish, conceited. You know, like me. So it's like that little child inside a person. You know, it's like me all the time. But what they don't understand, and I see this even with the monks as well, that monks who are a little, without being too critical, but it's a law in itself. If monks are a little bit too selfish, you'll see it quite clearly. You don't get happiness with that kind of perspective. It's something that you feel. And one of the lay women disciples who comes to the monastery on a weekly basis said she can actually, when she helps other people with handicrafts, with small things like beads and little patchwork things and little projects she does at home, and then she gives them as gifts for others, for homeless people, could be for charity, that she feels a sense of energy, excitement, a sense of joy. And you know, there's a person who can actually see the Buddha's teaching in action. When you see the energy, the underlying energy, which becomes joy and happiness, positivity, the goodwill, and you can actually you see it and you can feel it, then you know you've known directly within yourself what the Buddha was talking about. Sometimes people get you can be super, super smart, but you may not see this at all. You may be one of these very wealthy, affluent guys, you know, within the business economic sector. You know, you've got bags of money, you've got the best of everything. But, you know, I watch these people quite closely, and you can see that sense of unease, you know, the lack of kindness, the lack of self-respect, the lack of self-esteem. They don't really feel good about themselves at all. But, you know, the Buddha talked about this in multiple sutras, and all the solid practitioners can see this as clear as a bell. When you're too selfish, conceited, greedy, possessive, you don't want to share, you don't want to help other people, you know, you don't want to do nothing for no one. I don't care how many millions you've got, how much stuff you've got, you can have the best, the nicest home, car, tablet, phone, everything. But I can promise you, you will never be really happy as a human being if you're excessively selfish and you don't help and support others, you don't share, and just go out of your way. For, you know, all the meditators can see this. All the regular meditators know this and can see this, you know, quite clearly. But some people, you know, non-religious people who are super smart, but their minds are quite defiled, They just don't get it. They don't get it. I've seen very, very wealthy, affluent people who are very benevolent and generous. I've seen dirt poor people who are benevolent and generous. And those guys, whether it's male or female, whatever the social class, you can feel, it's tangible. You can feel the goodness inside them. And that is a source of the happiness that they have with them on a daily basis. And even people who are dirt poor, you can put this to the test. You can do things like, you can give a dollar to a poor person, or get a poor person a $2 coffee at a it could be anything, it could be at a petrol station, could be where we see those $2 coffees, and or things like giving a little bit of food to small creatures around one's home, in the backyard. You see an opportunity to help someone, and you just don't bring yourself into the equation, like, what's in it for me? You just go and do it because it's a wholesome thing to do. You're actually getting as much out of it as they are, and it's been proven in psychological studies that when a person does an act of kindness for another person, or no matter whatever level you're looking at, the person who gives to the other person gains more happiness than the person who receives, and it's proven. It's proven in psychological studies, and you can put it to the test. Even if you've only got $5 or $10 to spend on oneself. There are ways, like crumbs, from one's tabletop, from toast, the peelings from preparation that you can give to small creatures in the back garden, for birds and for insects and the like, this is something that the Buddha taught in the sutras. As the Buddha said, you come and see for oneself, and when you're developing that wholesome joy, coming from that good mind state, the less egotistical you are, the less your ego is in the way, the greater the sense of happiness, the return you get. The Buddha said that on a karmic level, that the less selfish you are when you do something good, something nice, something pleasant for another person, the greater the level of merit and happiness, because you're not bringing your ego, your sense of self into the occasion. You're trying to give from like an open heart. You're freeing the heart. You're giving, freeing the heart. And this is why that kind of happiness, that kind of merit, will be elevated compared to the person who thinks, well, I'll give a little as long as I get something in the return. So you're trying to do a deal, but that doesn't work so well. So it's very, very easy for me to, I have a lot of confidence in these teachings, but everyone concerned needs to test these things for oneself. And it could be something like looking after somebody's child when mum is trying to pack her groceries in the supermarket, or little things like helping someone across the road in traffic. And there's 101 things you can do for others on a daily basis. There's plenty of poor, helpless, disadvantaged people in general society. You can see, that you can see an opportunity half a dozen times a day, with no problem. And then you see, because the thing is as well that especially with the whole pressure with COVID affecting human society, economies, throughout countries around the world, and now that we've got this incredible humanitarian disaster in Ukraine with Russia invading, which is also it's like the adding to the pressure from the COVID infection and Omicron, and then another version of another variety of Omicron coming to the surface and being activated. So life is becoming difficult, and is becoming a struggle for many people, and they feel the pressure, they feel the depression, they feel the unhappiness, the quality of their life is getting affected. But that's but that thing, say for example, When I go see my mother at the nursing facility, you know, it's usually every week or two maximum. Is when I have lunch at the facility, I always clean up the buffet lunch bar, and when I'm sitting outside, I always wipe the table down completely, wash the cups, dry all the surfaces, and then I go up and see my mum after lunch, because the monks are expected to be clean and tidy, their kutis, their bathrooms, the paths, if you've got the time, especially with your kutis, you've got to keep your kutis clean, because it affects your mind state. If your kutis are a mess and there's at least 100 or 200 things just all over the place, you're not going to get good meditation with that kind of environment. So it just impacts you. It's quite subtle, but I've had monks tell me previously that their kutis were there. There was other stuff going on, but because their kutis were a mess, they weren't tidy, they couldn't meditate. Now this is just another principle of Dhamma. So when your environment is clean and tidy, you feel much better, more at ease within oneself. So there's a number of things there. Many of you are aware of the inner joy that we see within meditation, and then we have that spiritual joy that we develop in the world. So if I consider what other ways, helping, supporting others, having a sense of friendliness, treat other human beings as your friends. You don't have to overcommit yourself, overextend yourself, because sometimes we have to be careful. With the monks, it's much more easier to deal with, because the monks, people in general society expect the monks not to abuse them, not to mistreat them, at least to be polite to them, courteous, at least a little bit of kindness and compassion. They expect you to do that, as a practicing monastic. And even with the lay fraternity, they can see the difference quite clearly between the Buddhists and those people who have no religious doctrine at all. I mean, the Christians always have a degree of goodness, same with the people in Islam, the Hindus, any of the major sects that we see, the divisions within the religious faiths around the world, these people always have a sense, the vast majority of these people always have a degree of goodness, in them. That's the test of a religious teaching. The more goodness you see within a specific religious teaching, the more congruous, the more solid, the more meaningful, the deeper, more profound it is. I can't think of the right words. That's the test. For choice of better words, that's the test of a teaching, how it affects its disciples, how those disciples move and act and behave in general society. I've got one of my best friends two of my best friends from lay life. One's a practicing Christian, one was a former Christian priest for at least 7 or 8 years. And, they're very, very good people. I mean, I could trust those two guys with my life. It gives you an idea, the qualities that many, many religious faiths can develop over time. But so the sense of goodwill and even compassion to a degree, you have to be careful. Most people are pretty good, but you may have to be careful. The monks, it's a lot easier to deal with the lay fraternity. If you see that someone is okay, you can go out of your way, you can help them out, this and that. And how else, working for, getting involved, working for charities, even if it's only an hour a week. Say, for example, you're flat out, you've got kids, you're looking after a house, could have a part-time job, you've only got an hour a week to maybe do some charity work, for disadvantaged, for for disabled people. It could be anything. So, you know, many, many companies, groups, organisations, many, many of these professional groups or social groups, they need assistance, they need support. So even an hour a week. And when you reflect on that, so when you engage with the local community and you reflect on the good things that you've done for others, it could be things like organizing things for a disabled society. It could be very, very simple, very basic things, organizing like clothes for St. Vincent de Paul's or Salvo's, or sweeping the floor. This is not trivial stuff. It's not meaningful. When you do this stuff and you think along the level of like good karma and merit, and you're doing something good. Something good for others, and especially when you reflect on this stuff, you reflect on this kind of engagement, and you reflect on your personal experience. To give you an idea, this really started to. You may think it's funny, but this really started to resonate with me over the last couple of weeks, and I really underestimated this. But I've got a situation where, if I contemplate as much as I possibly can, I can't even have a nap after the meal, and it may sound odd. I'm wide awake at 4 a.m., 4:30, and I thought to myself, how come I didn't, see the full capability of this? The monks are always reflecting, but when I dialed it up, I went up to top gear and I kept doing it again, reflecting, I go over and over and over and over again, not wearing out my brain cells, but really getting up to top gear. Even after 5 hours, you're awake and you can't sleep. You can't sleep after the meal, the meal when you're usually a bit tired, after the early morning getting up, then you've got the heavy, a little bit of a heavy meal, you've only got one main meal a day. And it's subtle. Sometimes you don't realize the full impact of this, especially with sleep, things like sleep. That's something that everyone, most people, they love their rest. A good friend of mine, he said, he loves his bed. He loves to, just lay out, relax, and to stress, to be free and from stress, relax the physical body, the mind relaxes as well. But that thing, that energy when it's not to be underestimated, because with sleep, people can talk the talk, they can say all sorts of different things, but when you can't sleep, you can cut your sleep down. It makes you realize just how subtle that energy is. But it's also, that energy, you're taking it into samadhi, you're taking it into your meditation practice. So as many of you guys, for myself, I don't struggle to get peaceful. But with some of the practitioners, because of the busyness of lay life, you can accelerate the development of the meditation, the depth of the meditation, by increasing energy through contemplation. So when stuff comes up, you need to think and reflect, because the feelings, the thoughts which come up, if you ignore them, you don't pay attention to it, and you don't reflect on it and understand what's happening, no matter how trivial it is, could be a little feeling, could be something that somebody said, if you don't reflect on it, it's not going to go away. It's just going to keep coming back again and again and again, and it's telling you, that. I'm going to keep knocking at the door of the mind until you address me, until you understand what's happening, and so these things have to be addressed, they have to be seen to, and you'll see that very, very quickly. So as you move back between, you move back and forth between samadhi and contemplation, maybe even every couple of minutes, every 5 minutes. And you'll see the you'll see the mind calm down and get more peaceful more quickly. You know, because I can sit there. It doesn't take too long, but I mean, I could sit there for minimum an hour. Usually I see a really solid state after an hour. And as one teacher said, he didn't see real meditation until the second hour. So the first hour is just to get you peaceful and calm. The second hour, that's when you really, that's when you really do the work. That's when you get some real depth, some real samadhi. And even Bhante Gunaratana from Washington State, with the lay practitioners on at least weekends, 7-9 day retreats, you need to sit and walk for at least 3 to 4 hours at a stretch to really see deep samadhi. And there's absolutely no doubt I would agree with that. But if you want to really accelerate samadhi, you've got to keep the contemplation has got to be at the same level all the way right through to, from beginners to intermediate or further, because that even as discursive or irritating or disturbing as it is, you will raise more energy in a shorter space of time than sitting and walking for 2 or 3 hours. If you're going back and forth between the samatha practice and contemplation, you will easily increase the peace of the mind, the energy in the mind, absolute minimum 2 to 3 times over. And so as you know, it's something that you need to see for oneself. And also that thing as well, especially with karma, to help protect the purity of the mind, protect the energy of the mind. This is something that you see, good, wholesome people, they tend to have more mental energy than the negative, critical, depressive, greedy, selfish, narcissistic individuals. It's something you can see as clear as a bell. So even though, this is just a wild thought which came into my mind, so even people who are absolutely filthy rich, they've got millions and millions of dollars, they could be, the oligarchs are having a hard time with under Mr. Putin's incredibly bad strategy with Ukraine, just the absolute nightmare scenario. But even those guys, my attitude would be, if you're filthy rich, give 1% of everything you've got. If you're a multimillionaire, don't be afraid. Don't be frightened to give 1%, 1/100th of everything you make, every year, all the time, every week, every month. If you're making I'm only guessing, maybe $10,000 a month, or even $100,000 a month, give that 1/100th part to charity, to the charity of your choice, or every single week or every month, choose a charity and help and support those people, because you'll get more happiness from that than the bags of money that are the 99% of fat stash that you've got. That charity that you give, that 1%, will bring you more real intrinsic happiness than those fat bags of cash or those fat bank accounts that you have in your possession. So as I've said before, it's very, very easy for me to talk the talk, but it's something that you see for yourself. Even myself, even when I help the other monks in little ways, this, that and the other, could be things for the store, because I know exactly what we need for the store. I can easily organize it with my mother or my brother. It's almost like this willingness. I can feel it inside me. One of the ladies, the young woman connected with the monastery, said exactly the same thing. You feel this sense of exuberance where, like, I want to help you. I want to give some support. And this energy, and there's a sense of joy and a sense of will, you're willing to help, you're willing to support, because it feels good, it feels good. It's a source of of energy and happiness and goodwill and a sense of inner joy that you can take. You know, you do one small good thing and you could reflect on that every day several times, and it can make you happy for several. You could do something so trivial like give breadcrumbs to sparrows in the back garden, and you think about that several times a day, and that's a source of happiness for you. You know, but it's something you have to test and see for oneself.
Wonderfully said, Ajahn. Thank you very much. The simplicity of finding joy in just simple things, just very simple things. For example, just a smile, sharing a smile with someone.
Yeah, exactly. That's a fantastic proposition.
So maybe we can all share a smile together as we come to the end of the evening. But I do have a couple of questions here in the chat box. One from Diana. Diana says that she is fairly new to meditation and she got a bit confused about what words to use in the mantra you talked about and that we were using. Could you give us a little bit more explanation on this point?
Yeah. So the with that meditation, it's a very very simple meditation. So it could only be maybe four or even five words. So but the key principle is you need to choose an example would be say like feelings, then leave a space a couple of seconds, a changeable, so breathing, if you just use the mantra alone without complicating things, just do the mantra alone until you get the hang of it. You'll have the hang of it easily within 5-10 minutes. You know, you can feel it, and then feelings, leave a space, a changeable. So you can start with that, but you can choose absolutely anything that you want, anything which is important to you. It could be aspects of biology, chemistry, natural sciences, and you do the mantra in a very you do the mantra as you're breathing. It's a good idea as you're breathing out, because you're relaxing the physical body as you're breathing out, and you're looking at a sense of mental relaxation. So as I do the mantra, feelings, leave a space, a changeable. I'm relaxing the mind and I'm letting go of thinking. I'm letting go of thinking. So just very, very simple mantras, big spaces between the words, physical and mental relaxation and letting go. And absolutely anything you like. But it's a good idea not to swap and change too quickly. You need to reinforce and get a sense of firmness. So if possible, do nothing less than say 5 minutes at a time. If you have a lot of time on your hands, at least maybe up to 30 minutes or even an hour if you're not busy. And if you find that the mind is still quite busy, there's still excessive thinking, you've got a lot of stuff in one's daily life, that goes straight to the reflection, understanding what you're going through, the contemplation of thoughts and feelings, experiences, because the more you understand yourself, the easier it is to let it go. So if I have an incident with someone, and if I don't explore the dynamics, where that person was coming from and why, and the way I reacted and this and that, and this kind of thinking, reflecting, understanding. If you don't consider these things, receive them, understand them, they won't stop. They can just go on for months on end.
Yes, I know exactly what you're speaking about. Being a teacher in the classroom, those incidents often come up with students, and sometimes I'm mystified by them until I spend time contemplating on them. Ajahn, we have a couple of more comments. Yuni says, thank you very much for a very good talk and meditation. How did you start with going monastic to find the right monastery and teacher?
Yeah, I started right in the beginning. I mean, I had I was interested in Dhamma from say age 15, and I was reading different books. Started off with Alan Watts, and then started to get into say like Asian authors. So graduated. It's a lot of this is related to karma. So started from Zen, from like Western Zen Buddhism, and then what was it? Japanese Zen, Chinese Chan, and then Theravada Buddhism. So by late 20s, I started to, what was it? Mid-20s onwards, I started to travel. I went to Thailand. I didn't go to Sri Lanka at the time, but I had an affinity with Thailand. I was also interested in Japan, but for some reason never got there. But there was a lot of monasteries in Thailand which were accessible for retreats. I quite like Thai culture, the attitude. So I went to Thailand maybe about five times, I think. And I did meditation retreats while I was there. I traveled with my brother a little bit later. And but what happened was, so by age, I went to the Thai monastery up at Bundanoon, just over the escarpment there, inland from, Shell Harbour. Yeah, south of Wollongong, inland from Shell Harbour, over the escarpment, down the road in Bundanoon. I spent a number of, multiple weeks with the Thai monks there, and very, very, very peaceful, incredibly peaceful environment, good facilities. And So after spending time with the monks there at the facility at Sinyaturam, I'm not sure if I was a lay person at Wat Buddha Dhamma, I was a monastic Wat Buddha Dhamma. So I spent time in a number of, but the bottom line was that I needed a Western teacher. The Thai monks were doing quite well there at Sinyaturam, but I needed a Western teacher with full Western language, and the senior monk was very good, quite compassionate, very intelligent, was a doctor, but the Bundanoon was very cool, like spring and summer it's quite, it can be warm to very warm, but I wanted like a warm environment, Western teacher, established monastery. So in the end I came to Perth, and so age 30 I was in the monastery, and then I stayed on. So I met up with, I came to the monastery with meeting Achan Jagaro at Nolamara, and I mentioned that I was really interested in joining the community, this and that, and he's the golden words were along the lines of we'll see how you go. And if you go gently with the practice, it's a lot smoother. But unfortunately, I was too proactive, too much practice, and so you're up and down like a yo-yo emotionally. So in the end, you have to ease off. No matter how much drive, how much energy you've got, you have to ease off, because otherwise it gets a little bit painful, emotionally painful. So you've got to keep yourself in a happy range. Even myself, I don't push it these days. Once I start, once the defilements start to bite, or I start to get unhappy, my mood starts to drop, I just stop. I just stop right there. I go to contemplation, or I do other things. I clean the kuti, do some sweeping, do some reading, some study, a few bits and pieces, and. So in essence, from age 30, I'm 58 now, and so it's like, it's the way people's karma unfolds. It takes you in a certain direction. You may think that you've got, you've chose to go a certain way, but your karma is actually leading you by the nose, but you don't know it. It's coming up from a deeper level, and it's actually setting you off in a certain direction that you can't necessarily see on a deeper level.